root that means across, difference. So it's about like it's in diacritical. It's about the difference. So we're talking about reason, logos, across difference, about the importance of that gap between people's perspective. So it's a different way of thinking about thinking. In the past, with this tradition of rationality, there has been a perhaps inevitable tendency to pin down what we mean by thinking, to locate our algorithms and formal reasoning, something measurable, something visible. When we switch to dialogic, we're saying actually all thinking originates in and is surrounded by the context of the emergence of new creative meaning in a state of tension between multiple voices. In other words, there's never just one perspective. There's never just one truth. There's always another voice or several voices involved in any meaning. I hope that makes sense. So it's rather linked to this idea from Derrida, people like that, that we should take difference seriously, that we should switch from only thinking in terms of identity to thinking in terms of difference. But I'll unpack that in practice. I think it's very important for education. Oh, sorry, we're getting echo. Oh, well, do say if you can't hear. I've always liked this line from Voloshinov, who worked closely with Bakhtin in the 1920s in Russia, that meaning is like an electric spark that occurs only when two different terminals are hooked together. Because there's so much emphasis in the literature on meaning as some sort of thing, or knowledge even as a thing. So this idea of meaning as a spark, this metaphor of a spark is interesting because it's like a spark across difference. And without the difference, you don't get the meaning. As Josephine Mote emphasized in the PhD, which I'll be examining on Friday, Bakhtin pointed out that to really understand something, you need to be outside it. He himself was a scholar of ancient Greece, and he pointed out how his reading of the literature of ancient Greece really helped him to understand what was happening in Russia at that in those revolutionary times which he lived through. And his point was that it's the distance and the difference that you get that enables you to understand. But of course, this difference, which is so important for meaning, oh, I thought there was a different diagram there, but I'm going to explain through this. This difference that you get is not just difference. This is an example of dialogue. It's just difference. It's difference within a relationship. It's only by trying to understand the perspective of the other person that that difference becomes constructive and creative. And so it's this moving from a situation where people are centered on their own identities, on their own worlds, to one in which they are able to see themselves from the point of view of the other person and to build that difference into a relationship which makes it creative. So dialogue occurs in the context of some kind of relationship. But you'll notice that these shift in the centers of these circles, they do not completely overlap. It's actually impossible to understand somebody else or something else perfectly. There is no simple transmission of meaning because we all have different life histories. We all have different cultural horizons that we bring to bear. The inevitable creativity of dialogue comes from that gap of difference, which always continues. I think Merleau-Ponty has a very nice phrase to account for dialogic meaning, which he developed through his account of perception as a mutual envelopment. And the point is that in any dialogue, the other person you're talking to or you're relating to is not simply outside of you. That person is also on the inside. So everything you say, you're saying it with regard to them, and everything they say, they're saying with regard to you, and that, so there's a mutual envelopment. So even perceptually, if I look at you and I'm talking to you, you're part of my visual world, and I'm part of your visual world. And it's not true that we are outside of each other. We're already contained within those two overlapping horizons. So this difference is a difference that is within a relationship, which is not a closed relationship, but actually, as Merleau-Ponty would argue, because there's never a complete overlap, there's never a complete containment of any kind, there's an inevitable gap in between that relationship between, the outside and the inside, the sentient and the sensed, in any dialogue between the participants in a dialogue, which he calls a hinge. And that gap opens onto infinite possible meanings. That's all a bit, sounds a fancy language, but I'm sure you can understand if you think about the nature of creativity in a dialogue. So for instance, seems to leap around, the words I'm speaking now will be generating answering words, answering images, but they will come from your experience, they'll come from your lives. They're not going to be the same as mine, or everyone's going to have unique and different words, and yet they are relating together, they are working together to generate new meanings. So actually that generates, if you think about it, a creative space of infinite possibilities. So any dialogue, there's no perfect transmission. The only kind of dialogue in which you can perhaps approximate a perfect transmission of meaning would be between two computers. People aren't like that. Dialogue is always creative. So I like to articulate a dialogic principle. This is, of course, a philosophical joke because it contrasts to the identity principle, which often attributed to Aristotle and quoted at the beginning of logic, and it's that a thing is what it is and not another thing, and that the idea of reasoning is to reduce difference to identity. You know, you have all these different, apparently different things, and you reduce them to identity, so the identity of A equals A. But this is the opposite. This is saying that everything is everything else, actually. And dialogic is holding more than one irreducibly different perspective together in tension. So it's about thinking as something that's emergent and creative. So it's rather more than just a face-to-face dialogue. It's a bit more of a theory. Of course, comparing things in a table like this is not very dialogic, but I think it helps clarify, so I slipped into it. So we can make a simple contrast between monologic and dialogic. Dialogic makes sense from Bakhtin as a contrast to monologic. Monologic is what we have always called logic, basically, and what to some extent universities have been built around teaching rationality in the Enlightenment tradition. And in monologic, there's this idea that there is one true representation which you should be teaching. And so although we might have different perspectives, we might see things differently, we should overcome that. We should reduce it to a single true vision. Whereas dialogic says, well, no, actually you can't do that, because to have any meaning at all, it implies that there are multiple voices. It might sound strange. I'd be happy to answer questions on that. But I'll unpack it later in the talk. So monologic is the idea that meaning can be closed off and defined and finished, whereas dialogic says that we should that meaning is always open to the other. It's only in the context of the other that we have meaning, and that other isn't just a specific other. As will become clear, there's also, through every specific other, there is an otherness in general, a horizon of otherness, which actually makes meaning possible. So dialogic is saying that nothing is fixed, nothing is permanent, but the meaning is, the meaning of concepts, the meaning of ideas, occurs through that dynamic relationship, which is a kind of an openness to a horizon of otherness of that which is not the central concept. I'm making it all sound terribly complicated. It's not really, it's just the way it's hard to explain. So a focus on monologic is on representation, and dialogic is on relationship. That becomes ethically quite important in the work of Levinas. I thought that was very interesting, because as a Jew whose family suffered in the Holocaust, he was concerned to explain how the Western tradition of philosophy had made it all right to understand others by representing them. You're always thinking you understand. You've got a little model, you put them in the model. This is very much the tradition of psychology. The alternative, he suggested, was not to understand them, but to actually relate to them. Because when you relate to another, you find that they're bigger than you, that they're in some way transcendent, that you never really understand them. You can never really pin them down. And rather than ignoring that excess, as he called it, we could be open to it. We could relate to it. And out of that openness, out of that relationship, a deeper understanding emerges, which isn't the understanding of a closed representation or a closed model. I hope that tension becomes clear. And of course, it relates to everything else as well, to our relationship with nature, to our relationship with life in general. Rather than imagining we understand because we have a model, we could remain open-minded. As well as having useful, pragmatic models for doing things, we could be aware that they are limited, that they are temporary, and not confuse them with the deeper reality of our close relationship to that which is other than us and that which we're trying to understand. Hope that makes sense. So again, this, I think this relates to this thinking of identity and the thinking of difference that Derrida particularly introduced, which I found very, very inspirational and valuable. It's about taking difference seriously. With identity thinking, you think there are objects in the world, and then the difference is the difference between those objects. With difference thinking, you realize that actually it's the difference that creates the object. So the difference is constitutive. It's not just something that occurs after the event. A simple illustration would be in the language, in the grammar. I hope Finnish works the same as English here. But if you have two words like I and you, in a dialogue you have an I and a you, you have a self and an other. But those two identities are actually constructed out of the difference between them. An I cannot exist without a you cannot exist without an I. This is particularly interesting and evident if we look at how selves develop in the first place. Through our physicalist bias, you might think that a baby is a separate person, but a baby that's just come out of its mother's womb is not aware that it's a separate person. It becomes separate through interaction, through dialogue, it becomes aware of itself. It's a very interesting case where the difference occurs before the identity. Your emergence as a self occurs in relation to another. And the same is true throughout education. In a way, in education, we are giving birth to new selves, to new voices on the world. And those voices are not just separate, they don't pre-exist the dialogue. The dialogue, the relationship, comes before the separate voices. And the separate voices emerge within that relationship. So you're becoming a self in the context of a field of dialogue with other people, and it's only possible to do so. Is that clear? The interesting thing about, somebody said it's quite a difficult theory. And if you I tried to go into the neurophysiology of consciousness in the book to try and explain why it's so difficult. Because in order to be aware of things, we have to pay attention. You have to focus your consciousness on something. But when you think about it, in what field are you paying attention? There is a pre-existing field in which the self does not exist because the self is defined within that field. We cannot become aware of it. We can reconstruct it. We can think about it. But that's why it seems so difficult, because thought likes to work with clear boundaries, clear distinctions, clear differences. And what we're talking about here is, what's the context of that? And I'm saying that the context of that is a deeper and larger relationship which cannot be thought, which is actually bigger than thought. And that's, in a way, what dialogic is saying. We can't pin it down. But it's still important. You can still refer to it. It still has an impact on us, and it still can shape the direction that we go in, especially with regards to education. And that's, I suppose, what we're saying with the last point, that monologic tends to reification, to taking an outside view. But any outside view already presupposes an inside view. So although we like to imagine we can locate things in time and space, and there's a lot of talk about situated learning, everything being situated, but how do you know where that situation is? You have to see it from somewhere. I mean, you're always already inside a context in order to locate anything. You're always part of the system. And as part of the system, you can't get outside, and you can't see the whole thing, and you can't really pin it down. So when we think we ought to have that humility of recognizing that we're already on the inside, that we are already a perspective. Now, what I've presented there is ideas in the classic tradition of philosophy. We say we have, this is monologic, this is dialogic. But then you might want to ask, where do these ideas come from? How come they're important? Where did they arise? That would be taking a slightly evolutionary perspective, but I think it's valid. I think the internet age is an attempt to characterize what's most important about the current epoch. It would follow the sociologist Manuel Castells' very interesting set of books on the idea of that we're shifting into a new form of social organization he calls the network society, where the electronic networks are ways of mediating all our relationships. I think it's this equivalent of the shift from oracy to literacy, where literacy became increasingly important. I'll say a bit more about that in a minute. In other words, it's an epochal shift. We're only just at the beginning. Every week or every month, we hear about new uses of the internet, new things that have been discovered. We're just at the beginning of a different way of thinking that I think will be influenced by the internet, not in some simple causal way, but as an affordance of the communications technology, because they've had a big effect in the past. Calling it the internet age is a deliberate act. The publisher wasn't very happy because he said, well, I've had the internet for like 20 years now. He's obviously quite advanced. So it's old-fashioned, it's old hat. You should call it the cloud age or something modern. But I think we'll look back and we'll see that the advent of the internet was a major transition in human history, equivalent to the advent of writing. And it's making a distinction. When I was a child, I was told you have the Stone Age and the Bronze Age. And that kind of thinking, it's about the productive tools, really, Iron Age, is behind the calling it the knowledge age, that the means of production now, we're now producing knowledge. We're not producing pottery or stone, we're producing knowledge. Marx was very influenced by the anthropologist Henry Morgan, who came up with that schema. And he, of course, made it slightly more complicated because we didn't just have the tools. He thought humans were based on tools, but the modes of production that emerge from the tools. So you start off with primitive communism based on hunter-gatherers. Well, I think he just talked about the hunters. He probably didn't realize gathering was more important, but nonetheless, so they had small-scale societies, you get primitive communism, agricultural feudalism, industrial capitalism, all based on the tools of production again, you'll notice. But what about if we shifted it to look at the communication instead and how important that communication was? I think there's good reason for thinking that long before, even before oracy emerged, for perhaps a million years, human beings and their ancestors were engaging in mimesis, in gestures, in clowning, a pantomiming, you could call it. To explain something, you'd point, or you'd imitate the other person, and they would have to follow your body. Which is really interesting in terms of brain development, because to do that, in order to pantomime or to, I mean, I think if you've ever been in a situation where you have no language, you can still communicate. You can communicate with your whole body, and people do, and it can be amazingly effective if you try. But what's so interesting about that is actually implies a split in the working memory from a psychological point of view, that you have to be not only on one side, but also on the other side. You have to imagine how other people are seeing what you're doing. You have to see from the outside, from their point of view. So human beings have had millions of years of evolutionary development influenced by their ability to split themselves into two, to see themselves as an other would see them. And this, of course, carries on with, and this influences the way we think and what we mean by thinking. So in oracy, you naturally have a dialogic way of thinking. And it's so interesting that oral cultures all have a different tradition in which thinking is personified, in which nature has voice, in which ideas have a voice. And you'll see this even in the ancient Greeks, whereas the idea of being a philosopher is not a concept. It literally means a lover of Sophia, the goddess of wisdom. And I think that meant something to them in a way that it probably doesn't to us. Because writing, and particularly print, has introduced a different way of thinking. A way of thinking which has the affordance for monologic, which I was describing, because it turns everything from being a relationship with a voice, from always being aware that you're seeing things from multiple perspectives, to this idea of reifying meaning and pinning it down. And what's so exciting for me about the internet, I hope this is still okay, the sound. What's so exciting for me about the, unlike other dominant communications media, including television, including radio, the internet has a real affordance for dialogue, for participation. It's a two-way medium. In recent revolutions, people always go for the television studios. If you take over the television and the radio and the print media, then you control what's going on. In education, the people who are in control of the printing press and who print the textbooks, they can determine what the curriculum is. That is what print has, this affordance for truth with a capital T, which is very much, as Foucault would say, a regime of truth, an effect of power. You know, you control the center. I'm not saying this is negative, it sounds negative, but it's something that can only really occur with writing and with print. The very first example of writing, I believe, is Hammurabi, where they found stelae in different city centers of his empire with the law codes. So that's what writing makes possible. You can hammer out the law codes in the capital, and then you can send them off and you can bang them into every village so everybody knows what the law is. You could control space, as it were, by means of writing in a way that you can't with talk, with oracy. It's a very different experience. And it leads to a very different idea of education. So education in oral societies is initiation. It's an induction into the larger cultural dialogue, which involves actual encounters with the ancestors and the gods. And this is a different vision. I think that we're still doing the same thing, but we're misrepresenting it. I think the ancestors, their heads have been chopped off, they've been pickled, they've been put in books in the library, and we're drawing people into this amazing community of voices. But we imagine that there are some kind of, that the truth and the knowledge, we often imagine, is in the books, is in the representations. And that's a distortion that writing has brought in. So what I'm trying to say is that what I'm calling it the internet age is quite significant, because I'm saying that the dominant thing that's going to characterize the new age isn't the means of production so much as the means of communication. And the communication isn't just about moving symbols from one place to another. It's about a form of relationship. Oh, I'm taking too long here, aren't I? So I've got till 1:30. So if I stop at 1:15, we can have questions. Is that right? Good. Fine. So obviously this is influenced by McLuhan's idea that the medium is the message. I think I'm just repeating what I've just been saying there, that oracy arises from bodies and is situated. And so although it has tremendous affordances for dialogic, it also has a limitation. One of the key limits, I studied anthropology as my first degree as well as philosophy. And everyone was always terribly positive, of course, and they said all these stories of cannibalism are exaggerated. And after a while, I gradually realized that, yes, every small-scale society is at war with every other small-scale society and always has been. And it's not just ritual, it's not just fun when you get hit with an arrow or whatever. It's real. And people tend to gloss over that. And why is that possible when, if you talk to the people or if you read the records, there's clearly dialogic wisdom there. The moral codes are just as profound, and all our profound moral codes emerge from oral periods, because the moral code is the golden mean, do as you would be done by, that arises in a dialogic relationship. You have to see things from the other person's point of view. It's very clear in Confucius, who, again, it was his dialogues that were written down. Socrates' dialogues were written down. Jesus Christ, it's his talk that was written down after the event. Because even after writing was available, societies were obviously predominantly oral. And so what's going wrong here? How come you have moral codes that are so wise and you have universal warfare? Well, because of the limitation, I would argue, or possible reason might be, that oracy, talk, is limited to the here and now. It's limited to the physical and temporal space. And writing took off because then you could disembed meanings from their location, you could put them in a book, you could send them overseas, you could convert people everywhere in the world to your religion, your truth, your law code. And the tremendous affordance of that is bringing people together, creating much bigger empires. That's interesting. Hopefully the internet offers this possibility of a return to the affordances of dialogue without a limited community. So it's not just the dialogue community who you're responsible for, it's an unbounded community. And I want to explore what that might mean in terms of ethics in the future. Socrates was actually around at the time when the first big communications revolution took place. He was an oral thinker. He didn't write anything down. Plato wrote his talks down and probably misrepresented them. So we don't know if we're dealing with Socrates or Plato, of course. But he was very critical of writing. And I always find this amusing when I read. People are quite aware of this now because a few people have mentioned it, but so much of the criticism of the internet is so similar to Socrates' criticism of writing. He said, you know, people, when they talk, they have to be intelligent. They have to respond. Now that they've written everything down, they can give a wonderful speech, but if you ask them a question, they won't know how to answer because actually they've just borrowed it from the scroll. That writing is like a picture. You know, it looks pretty, but it can't answer back. And intelligence, he said, lies in the relationship. It lies in the answering back. It's the dynamic thing that writing can't do. So he thought writing would essentially be a moral danger. And, you know, I think he's probably been right. So it's very similar to what everyone's saying about the internet. You know, they're saying with the internet, people aren't in, they're not reading deep books and they're not having to think. And there's been that criticism from The Shallows by, oh, I've forgotten, Nicholas Carr. And various people have lined up to be worried about the brain changes that are occurring with the internet. And it's not all nonsense, but it's also similar to Socrates that it must make you think. And I think it should draw our attention to the way in which writing has changed our brain. So this dialogic distinction was brought in by Socrates, I think. It's something you see very clearly in the Bible. There's a nice phrase, it's Corinthians, the letter kills, but the spirit brings life, which is quite interesting. And Socrates more or less said the same thing in the Phaedrus. He said that when you put meanings in words and you don't know who they're for, and they could be for everybody, they're like seeds on flagstones in the sun. They're just going to wither away and die. They lose their meaning because the meaning comes from the relationship. Words only mean when you're talking to somebody, when they're for somebody, when you're in a relationship. And that's the essence of the definition of dialogic from Bakhtin. He said, to understand the meaning of a word, you can't see it in isolation. You have to see where it is in the dialogue, what it's responding to, where it's going. And that's true of any utterance. There are no meanings that can be completely abstracted from their context. They're always responding to the past, they're responding to something, and they're trying to achieve something. And Socrates had already said this. He said, that's what's wrong with writing. You all think this is marvelous, this new invention, but actually it's going to make you think badly, because real thinking is in a dynamic relationship. But on the other hand, as an oral thinker, he seemed to associate that real thinking with the warm breath, which I think is quite interesting, because breath, I don't know how to pronounce it, pneuma in Greek, is another word for spirit. You know, the breath in the dialogue was kind of like where the spirit was located. Whereas the difference with modern dialogic theory is that we'd say the difference is an abstract difference. It's not about the warm breath. It's not something you can pin down. It's actually a difference between texts is equally dialogic, or a difference between perspectives in general. I wanted to mention the brain science because I think it's so interesting to realize when I hear people talking Finnish, I can't even see where one word begins and another word ends. It's words. It's just words to me. And for oral people, it's very hard to distinguish separate words. You can't pin them down. You can't visualize them. You can't reflect on them in the same way. The brain has undergone changes as a result of literacy. Very interesting study by Stanislas Dehaene from Paris. I introduced him when he gave a keynote at the early conference in Exeter last year and talked to him about these ideas. And he's, by studying literates and people and non-literates and people becoming literate, he can point to quite marked changes in the brain that occur. And what's so interesting is this shift from the holistic perception, because it's taking over the same bits of the brain, so there's something's lost as well as something being gained. There's a loss to some extent, only a small loss, of our ability for holistic thought, as we are trained in writing in schools. And there is an increase in our ability for analytic thought, i.e. for pinning things down, for focusing on the center of attention, for losing touch with a larger context. And I'm raising that because, in some ways, Socrates' distinction that he's making, well, what he's saying is wrong with writing, and what he's saying is right about dialogue, is something that might be hard for us to understand, because we are literates, and we can't understand the experience of somebody who wasn't a literate. And that experience was different. He wasn't engaging in abstract concepts in the same way because he couldn't visualize them. And these brain studies show that when we engage in dialogue, the visual, when we hear words, the visual parts of the brain are activated in a way that they're not with oral people. In other words, we're seeing the words frequently. And seeing them turns them into some kind of thing. It turns the meaning into a thing that we can then manipulate. But the meaning isn't really a thing, it's a dynamic relationship that we're engaged in. I think that's what he was trying to say, and he had, you know. So I think that's kind of interesting. Toulmin is also very interesting, just to explain where the modern university system comes from. Because, of course, universities, going back to the Middle Ages, were centers of oral learning, of rhetoric, of teaching, thinking as a dialogue. And according to Toulmin, the humanists had a very strong emphasis on dialogue. Dialogue was still the main image of thinking until the 16th century, when people like Descartes and Leibniz and Newton and so on shifted the image. Whereas before, thinking had been about utterances in a dialogue, i.e. there is a relationship there is a context, and you're one voice amongst many, to this idea of propositions in proof. That's only possible with print. In print textbook, you can visualize, you can pin down meanings, you can say that's true, that's false, in abstraction. So there's a truth outside of any dialogue where there aren't multiple perspectives, there's just a true perspective. And this became the dominant image of thinking around about the sixth, according to Toulmin. So I think that the technology of print has not determined this shift, but it has made possible a monologic shift in the way of thinking, which translated into education as the idea that we are transmitting cultural knowledge. It's most clearly expressed by E.D. Hirsch, who at the moment is the most popular educational theorist with the government. And they love his stuff. He wrote this book, basically what books Americans need to read to education is about the transmission of cultural knowledge through books. Knowledge is a representation, it's over there in the library, it's in the book, it's in the theory, it's in the picture, and people need to know it. You need to transmit it. They need to read the right books. The curriculum is the right books, not any books. You can't just, you know, watch Simpson videos. You have to read this set of books, and that's your culture. That only makes sense with print and schools, and I believe modern universities are very much seen as places where, for reading, for writing, for the transmission of books, which has obviously been a very successful and important tradition. I'm not trying to knock it. I'm just trying to put it in context to imagine the significance of a historical shift that in some ways returns us to a vision of education that predated writing, a vision of education as dialogue. The significance of this in relation to thinking skills can be seen from this simple but important account by Bakhtin of the difference between an authoritative voice and a persuasive voice. Let's take this example of an apparently non-dialogic sign. You see a sign saying, no smoking. It's on the wall. Now that's just, no one in particular has said this. It's not a dialogue, it's just saying, don't. It's authoritative. So either you accept that, I can hear, oh. What should I do? It might go away of its own accord. Did I go too close? Well, it still seems to work. Maybe if I walk over here. Yeah. A little bit lower. Can you still hear me now at the back? Okay.
sorry.
See, technological mediation always brings limitations as well as enhancements, doesn't it? You know, any idea of affordance, there's, for everything you gain, there's always something you lose.
Just a minute, I'll just check this.
Oh, that's okay.
It's still on.
Ah. Oh, if we just keep it a long way off, it might be all right. Oh, is it this one that's working? Oh, but I'll have trouble getting down that low.
So if you put that off.
Okay, I can do that here, can't I? Okay. I think that's switched off. Oh, okay. Can you hear me now? Maybe there wasn't a problem before. I didn't really know, because I'm only on one side. Right. Well, the significance of this... Sorry, you can't hear me? Or can you hear at the back still? Is there any sound? I could just talk, probably. The significance of this for education is clear, because if you have a sign saying no smoking or the authoritative sign, and remember, Bakhtin was around under Stalin and everything, so he knew what he meant by the authoritative voice, you can't engage with it. You either accept or you reject it, but you can't actually engage. And so you don't really learn to think, is his point, I think is the implication. It's only the persuasive voice which actually engages you in thinking, where the words cross your barrier, as it were. They enter into your words, and they mix with your words and create new hybrids, and they become creative. So, for instance, if my friend, and I do have friends like this, I used to smoke once, they say, you know, well, look, my mother used to smoke and she got sick from cancer and it's really not a good idea. You start thinking about that. That becomes part of you. That becomes part of your voice. And, of course, that in education, you will often find, even in universities which are dedicated to the ideals of thinking, that science subjects and other subjects are taught as facts that are transmitted, as authoritative. I have, in England at least, I've come across a few people who've dropped out of their science courses because it was so boring. And I find that disturbing, because for me science is so exciting and so interesting. And when I try and find out why it was boring, it's the way it was taught. It wasn't taught as an inquiry that you get engaged in, where there are multiple perspectives and your voice is interesting. And when you look at science at the moment, all these amazing cosmological theories and interpretations of quantum theory, and for me that's very exciting. But it's not taught like that. They just teach the history. They teach the stuff that's fixed often. I'm not saying they do here. I have no idea. But this is what he's talking about, the difference between the authoritative voice. Well, you either just become a disciple, a vassal, a servant of the science, a creep, as it were, or you just drop out. You know, there's no real engagement. And it's the engagement where the thinking occurs, where you the idea of teaching would be to induct people into their capacity to engage in the dialogue to be scientists themselves, which should, of course, be an open-ended inquiry, not a series of facts. I think I've done that one about the history of communication earlier, but that's what I'm trying to say. Why dialogic is important now is because the internet, why I think we're talking about it, why ideas have shifted since the advent of the internet, why dialogic has become so important, is because our understanding of knowledge is changing. And in a way, this can be simply illustrated by the difference between Wikipedia and traditional encyclopedias. I've actually used an example that my son pointed to. It's a visual Wikipedia. Because the internet is also multimodal. It's also about vision, music, faces. Rather, as in oral societies, people would use icons, they would use cave paintings as a way to access cultural voices, increasingly on the internet, we have embodied voices, we have avatars, we have videos of thinkers. And in Quickipedia, which is like Wikipedia, only with images and multimedia, you have that same effect. When I started teaching at Exeter, I went to these little meetings about... And a lot of people complained that students were using Wikipedia and they didn't realize that anyone could change Wikipedia and you just can't reference Wikipedia. I thought that's interesting because I always used Wikipedia and found it very useful. And I think the point they were trying to make is illustrative of a vision of knowledge. Because if you're looking for authoritative knowledge, you don't want to use Wikipedia because you don't know who wrote it last. But if you're going to use Wikipedia, you should be wised up to the fact that it's a dialogue, that you don't just look at one voice, you look at other voices. So it's no longer knowledge in the way that the encyclopedias were trying to be, where you have an editorial board, you get the leading expert, and if you read it in the encyclopedia, you kind of know it's true. It's authoritative because it's print-based, and print is one-to-many, and you have a central editorial. Wikipedia is, there are multiple voices, it's participatory. It doesn't mean you don't learn anything, and in fact, on a factual basis, recent studies have shown Wikipedia comes out better in every respect because it's more up-to-date, there's more fact-checking, as well as the problem of someone might, as a joke, have said something silly in the last week and you can't quite be sure. But the point is, it's a different vision of knowledge. It's not knowledge as fixed and authoritative, it's knowledge as participating in a dialogue. To use it effectively, you should participate, and by checking other voices, you're already implicitly participating in that dialogue and making judgments yourself. So in order to be to access the knowledge, you need to be a participant. You need to become a thinker yourself. So that's the simple account of this participatory view of knowledge, which makes sense in the internet age, but that is based on a dialogic theory of meaning and of knowledge. So it's not a passive representation, but active participation in dialogues that we should be looking for. This leads to this idea I've tried to outline of dialogic space. I've already been arguing, and I think this is the argument that Socrates was making, that dialogues aren't an external fact. Maybe two robots could interact only in external space, but two humans generate their own space of meaning, which is unique in every case and is a potentially infinite space. So that if you're talking to somebody, you might be in a room in a particular year, in a particular day, but you're not really located because you could be talking about Alaska or going to Mars or what happened 1,000 years ago. So the internal space of dialogue is much bigger potentially than this external space. So dialogic education, I think you can see, doesn't simply progress by moving from A to B. You've got somebody who doesn't know something or is ignorant in state A. In state B, they know it, so there's a simple transition. Okay, it might happen like that in some areas sometimes, but the essential movement is expansive. You're moving from A to A plus B. So think about Bakhtin. By learning about ancient Greece, he didn't just lose being a Russian and knowing about Russia in the 20th century. He knew about ancient Greece in the 5th century BC. He didn't just leave one and go to the other. He had two voices. And as we learn, we don't lose. We acquire different voices, different perspectives, which enrich our understanding. So it's in that sense, this idea of dialogic space is actually what we're teaching. We're actually expanding the space of dialogue. We're bringing things out of a merely physical or one-dimensional space, and we're bringing them into a space of meaning. In order to understand them, we're relating them to multiple other voices. So that should be the purpose of education, I would argue. It's similar to that education in oral societies where you initiate people into the cultural voices of the ancestors and the traditions that are ongoing. Here you are inducting people into the ongoing dialogue, and through engaging in that dialogue and widening it by bringing in more voices and deepening it by reflecting on its assumptions, you are expanding a space of dialogue. I'll just quickly whiz through a couple of antecedents for dialogic education. I probably won't have time. I'll just move fast to move on to the questions. I thought it's worth mentioning Freire, who advocated dialogic education in the context of education for the oppressed, and it was in opposition to a banking model. He was seeing education as something that was being applied to people in a way to oppress them further, and he was arguing that it should be about giving them their voice, allowing them to engage and create. I think there's something a little bit suspect, though, about starting off with this opposition of oppressor and oppressed, because I never know which side I'm on, and I'm sure a lot of people don't. But nonetheless, a very powerful and influential dialogic theory of education, which I expect you're familiar with. I just thought I should mention some of the tradition. And what interested me I did a sort of literature review on dialogic education, is how similar the ideas of this conservative English philosopher, Michael Oakeshott, are. I was particularly, I'd heard of him, but when our conservative government took over education in England, they were quoting Oakeshott, because he's a political theorist who they like, a conservative political theorist. But his account of education is really dialogic, and it's impressively dialogic. And interestingly, it's arguing from a similar base to that of Freire. He's saying at the moment they're trying to turn education into something economic. The bankers are taking over. They want tools for the economy. And we should fight for dialogue as an end in itself. Education is not about, no, it's not just about, well, he said it's not about. It's about drawing people into what he called the conversation of mankind. Humanity, shall we say, these days. But yeah, I think he meant everybody. And he's saying this is a long conversation that is a conversation with our ancestors that's going to continue in the future, and that's what education is for. We should draw them into that dialogue, and in that dialogue, there's no hierarchy, there's no one who can say what's right or wrong. It's not designed to an end other than itself. It is about itself. He calls it conversation, but it is a dialogic account of education. And I find that almost amusing, because obviously Freire was a radical in a context where it was important to be radical. Oakeshott seen as a conservative, because what he's carrying on is the oral tradition from Socrates. The University of Cambridge was really, really old, and it was carrying on that the importance of dialogue in studies and so on in little group meetings, and he hated what was happening because the system was taking over with mass education. And I think that's kind of important because it shows where technology is important. These dialogic moves in theory have been reactions, they've been contained. You have small groups of adult education doing Freirean approaches to dialogue. You have some dialogue going on in Oxbridge studies. But with mass education, it's very hard to achieve that. The technology takes over. It quickly becomes about the bureaucracy and the examinations. And that is where the internet might make things different and might make things possible, because their image is a face-to-face image, that of Socrates. And this limits its scope. The new image, dialogic is no longer just about face-to-face dialogues of people using words. We can unpack a bit what dialogic education is from that tradition before I move on to how we need to change it in the internet age. It's saying that the aim of education is not just teaching through dialogue, it's teaching for dialogue. You should be teaching how to participate in dialogue. And it's not teacher-centered or student-centered. So Freire would be seen as a student-centered person, perhaps, like Dewey. Oakeshott perhaps was arguing, well, you do need teachers. It's about the dialogue. We actually need teachers. You need both perspectives in relationship, because there is a past. There is a conversation you're joining. You want to learn about that. Any conversation is always wise to actually stop and listen a little bit and find out what the words mean, what the rules are, before you join in. So we're centering on the relationship itself, not on one side or the other. But it's also about, as Freire pointed out, it's about finding a voice. You don't find a voice in isolation. You only become yourself in a community with others, in relation to others. And that's true within a narrow field as well as within in life in general. So if you want to learn, if you want to understand Darwin's theory of evolution, you need to understand the dialogues he was engaged in. We need to understand why it's different from Lamarck, for instance. I remember I was a schoolboy. I didn't understand it until I understood it wasn't the same as Lamarck. It wasn't that the giraffes were stretching there. And without you become part of that dialogue, and then you find your own position within it. Eventually, you can participate. You know where you are. So you're taking on a field of dialogue in learning. And then that's how you find your own authentic voice in every area. And the other principle is you should draw people into that motivating flow of dialogue before you teach them the basic skills they need for the dialogue. That might sound counterintuitive, but it's also kind of obvious, in a way. Unless people are motivated and engaged, why would they want to go away and drill? When I'm trying to learn another language, I'm very happy to do drilling and boring exercises because I want to talk to people. And if you just start with the exercises, which so often education does, for some eventual participation, the sense of the meaning is often lost. So you should start with the meaning and then go and then say, well, actually, you could do... I understand your exciting ideas about quantum physics, but they might be rather better if you'd actually read something. And people can engage more. That's the idea. So it's about drawing learners into participation in those dialogues that are powerful, that surround them. But there are two differences we need to introduce to Socrates. First of all, it's not just about words. It's multimodal. It's about images, videos, music. It's the vision of dialogue has to expand and to understand where creativity comes from. But also, and I think most interestingly, dialogue with the internet isn't just... It can contain a dialogue between one or two or three people, but frequently you get involved in dialogues with a community, and they are dialogic. Even a simple Google search will involve you. You'll find a list of responses, and then you'll read a few voices. You'll probably have to change your search terms in order to continue. You're actually engaged in a dialogic process, but who are you dialoguing with? Frequently, in any area, you'll come across a community who are engaged in this dialogue. My mother has been searching the origins of her name and finding all our ancestors, and she ended up talking to other people searching for the ancestors and the sharing bits of data. She became involved in a community that was constructing knowledge together. And the same is true in any kind of education on the internet is tremendously supported, but it's participatory. It's very different from the kind of education you get in school. It's dialogic, but it's not always dialogue with one or two other people. It's often dialogue with an unknown horizon of resources. There's an almost infinite number of voices and resources out there that you engage with in a responsive and contingent manner. So we have to shift what we mean by dialogue. I've used Merleau-Ponty's theory of the chiasm here, this center-periphery dialogue of the mutual environment between the center and the horizon, because I think that's what's going on, and that's what makes it so powerful and creative. And I'll give you a brief illustration. You've probably come across this new movement of MOOCs, which is very exciting. But they discovered there was a little course they were doing in Canada, and they had about 20 people on the course, but thousands of people around the world also joined in for free because they weren't trying to get accreditation, and they were generating resources, and they were discussing the issue, and that greatly enhanced the course. And this model was taken up by Stanford, and they're generating a number of courses where there are, I know you probably can't read the text, but basically the idea that it's open, it's global, that on Facebook, in various forums, on Twitter, you get thousands of people discussing the issues, generating the resources. And this is what I mean by internet dialogue isn't about face-to-face, isn't the same as face-to-face dialogue. It's active generation of meaning through a dialogue between you as the person with the focus, with the question, and this unbounded horizon which is responding to you. Each time you do a search, each time you engage, you get feedback, you modify your question. The aim, of course, as with Socrates, is still not about finding the truth so much as asking better questions. You're developing the questioning through this process. But it's a dialogue with a horizon. And this time, the horizon isn't just your language community, your little tribe, your village, your town square. It has no limit. When you say global, there's no actual limit to that. For all we know, there could be people from Mars on the internet. I mean, you can't actually pin it down. You can't get outside of it. And I think that's interesting. So I'll just summarize then what this leads us to. Oh, I didn't really do my illustration, which I promised, because I always like that. I focus on the theory. I do apologize. It's just what interests me. I hope it was of interest to some of you. But I think we can see that what we need to teach is how they can learn to learn together with others on the internet. I like that L2L2 because there's a lot about learning to learn, which is rather individual implicitly. But the real skill we need now is how to work with others on the internet, often in teams, but often, as I say, in an unstructured way. How do we learn from others? And of course, you need to learn the dialogue so far, and you need to teach this expansion of dialogic space. And how to teach it? Well, there are various ways in which we can open, widen, deepen, and resource that dialogic space. And this is interesting. I think you'll find it does suggest that education is a mission. It's about participating in the global dialogue of humanity as an end in itself. It's an end in itself, but implicitly we have a sort of horizontal event here, which you could call global democracy, but it's not about democracy as voting. It's about would it be possible to live in a world where people did try to understand each other in general and were open to the other in general in such a way that we could go beyond the continuing state of the perpetual war of everyone against everyone else, and we could try and create some sort of global dialogicocracy, if you like, i.e. managing our affairs through dialogue rather than through conflict or whatever. And clearly that's a possibility that the internet has suggested and is indeed making increasingly necessary as the world is wired up, so what happens in China affects what happens in America. And education would have a crucial role to play in making that possible, because unless people are dialogic, unless they are learnt to shift their identities from a focus on a bounded image of themselves and their self-interest to take into account the fact that they're actually part of that much larger system and that their very sense of self depends upon it, that's to be a dialogic person, basically to be open to the others, to be responsive and so on. Surely that's a good mission for education. I would have stopped there and asked for questions. I did have a very brief illustration. It's not that interesting. Just as a teacher, I taught something by getting students to blog about it. We had a stimulus, we had lectures. They blogged. They didn't just blog on their own. They had to and were marked for commenting on each other's blogs. And their assessment was their blog, their edited and adapted blog. And I was just going to give that illustration of how easy it is. I was given a course I had to do, I did it that way. In this day when almost everyone's on Facebook, it would be very easy to structure situations such that the teaching was about people finding their own voice through collaborative learning with others, bringing in all the resources of the internet and all the multiple voices out there. So it wasn't an exciting illustration. I hope we've still got 5 minutes left for questions. Oops, sorry. I'll stop there. Sorry, are there any questions about this or things that you want to challenge or didn't understand or disagree with or...
Hello. Well, thank you very much, first of all, for this wonderful presentation. I would actually like to, before asking my question, to point out that there are, other than the MOOCs, there are also companies that are already entering in this world of education, of massive education through internet. Pages like Coursera and others are gathering many lecturers from many different universities, which are free and open to anyone who wants to enter in these lectures. But my question was, and this presentation you gave was based on the fact that the dialogue, the dialogic education would actually thrive upon, like, will convince others that this rigid previous education system we had was, in a way, monotonous and didn't allow to actual knowledge to be transmitted because knowledge is has to be dialogic. But in these web pages, like Coursera and others, you still have a teacher which, more than a guide, is setting still the education system. And even though you still have forums of thousands of people, that doesn't really change the final aim of the lesson. So how could this media actually evolve to the point that the actual education that happens sometimes in a classroom through dialogue goes through a big classroom in internet without having just one voice of the teacher still?
Yes, thanks. That's a great question. I'll do my best to answer it. It's a great question. Thank you very much. But I think what I didn't really have time to outline was that in the history of the relationship between communications media and, shall we say, mentality or ways of thinking, it's quite clear that it's not determined. It depends on the practices. It depends what you do with it. But what I'm suggesting is that different media do have affordances. That means they make some things possible that weren't possible before. They make some things easier. In this case, we're just at the beginning of an emerging new model. And your question illustrates the need for educational theory. We need a theory and we need education in order to make things that are possible happen. You mentioned this massive amounts of resources on the internet, but how do people use them? How can they use them? One thing that interested me when I visited Monterrey, the Tec de Monterrey in Mexico last year, was they're running 3,000 to 4,000 local centers of learning, little centros de aprendizaje comunidades. In the community, they have a place where you go and you play with the computers, but they only had a few courses there, mostly basic skills. At the same time, they were providing collected portals to these collected education bases. It would be quite logical. They didn't have teachers there. They had local people who were facilitators, who were animators, who encouraged them, basically, so you'd support them. How easy would it be for anybody to learn anything in that way, working as a community with others, either on the internet or face-to-face in their local community center? That's an emerging model of higher education that the internet makes possible, but of course, it's not necessarily happening because we have an inherited idea of what education is, what it means to be a teacher, that is going to take a long time to change. But that's why it's worth having these kind of talks. It's worth thinking about it. It's worth developing theory. And that's why I love studying education, because it seems to me many other disciplines are happy to describe the way things are, whereas you can't be in education unless you want to change it, because that's what it means. You know, you have to decide, what are we going to teach? How are we going to change people? How should we change them? So it's a good question, but I guess I'm being idealistic, and it's up to us to do it. It's not actually just happening on its own. But I do go into that a bit elsewhere, you know, in terms of literature I can point you to. Well, the book, basically.
More questions, please? There's still time.
Oh.
My question was about the difference between face-to-face dialogue and then online dialogue. Because often in education, when we come together in the classroom, it can be quite challenging to get people to talk. But there's this kind of picture that when people are online together, then the interaction is so much more easier. So is there some kind of qualitative difference, or is it significant, the difference between dialogue online and dialogue being there together in person?
Yes, I think it's very different. There are some affordances. You will find there are always a few people who are quite shy face-to-face but are happy to engage on the internet. If you're sitting around a table with a group of people and somebody like me is talking all the time because they think they know what they're talking about, it's quite hard to interrupt. It's quite hard to take the floor. But online, people find it a lot easier, some people. There are problems. There are obviously issues. As well, but that would imply that it has the affordance to facilitate a more equal kind of dialogue where people aren't intimidated by status or physical stature and all the rest of it, and there's some feedback on that. It particularly relates to gender roles. But I think all this is emerging, and what interests me, it is a different kind of dialogue that is emerging, because it is no longer, it is dialogue. But let's take an educational development by MIT with scratch computing, where a lot of children mainly around the world, but adults as well, are sharing and creating together things with the software program in a community. And it seems to work very well. It seems to engage. But it's not two or three people. It's the fact that there is a community there, so that when you have an inquiry, you ask the community, and some people get back to you, other people might get together and prepare a response. It's that kind of dialogue with a community which is new and different and seems to be very powerful, and which they're taking advantage of in this MOOC phenomenon, however limited it is. And that's a new kind of dialogue which we're just exploring and experimenting. But it's still dialogic. You see, that's where the word dialogic as a technical term becomes useful, because it's not just face-to-face dialogue anymore, but it is an emergent meaning created out of the tension between perspectives. In this case, your individual interest and focus and this active horizon of the community around you who are responding. So it's still a dialogic learning process. Sorry, is that getting theoretical again? It's certainly different. I mean, and there's an empirical question to explore those differences, but there are differences there for everybody. So shall we leave it there? I'm sure we've got other sessions.
Okay.
Oh, sorry. I don't know if there's time.
Okay, last little question.
A short one. Thank you for the very exciting presentation. I was looking at the last words on your slide here now. You talk about global dialogic democracy, and you hesitated a little bit about the democracy. And that relates to my question really on formal and informal learning. We have seen the change already, like many universities, especially in the UK and US, do have lecturers, do have research lecturers, and a lot of material online, and it's increasing all over the world globally, that we have more and more materials and even discussions, dialogue online going on. And that has created some fear among ministries of education. I read a document published by UNESCO recently on the future of education systems. Yes. What happens? What is the future? Is it going to be that there's more emphasis on informal learning rather than formal learning, because so much happens through internet globally already, even in the global south, where access to internet is more limited. Still, it happens. And there was a discussion, but then on the other hand, I think it would be interesting to hear from you that how do you see this, how you represent formal education system, and at the same time you do look at this dialogue going on through internet. How do you see that where these sort of different ways of learning or forms of learning do interact, and how can we as formal educators recognize the competencies and learning that takes place, or that competencies that people do acquire through different means, like through dialogue, through dialogic learning, when they take part in different
activities? Yes, thanks. That's a great question. And obviously it's a question, I don't have an answer to it, but I'm very interested in it and engaged with it. And it could go on for a long time. I don't know how long, but I think it's an important question. One of the arguments I make, just a simple argument from business studies, that this is a disruptive technology, that we think we know what education is, we have all these systems geared around it, and the internet actually does the same kind of education better. When I'm watching TV with my son or my family, something comes up, I actually have a little iPad, and I Google it all the time, and we're learning all the time, and often we're engaging with dialogues with other people implicitly, you know, different perspectives, and I think that's just amazing, but it stops at the school gates and probably at the university gates, because there somebody needs to control the curriculum, they control the knowledge, and they accredit the learning. The interesting thing about MOOCs is that thousands of people are participating in generating knowledge for free, and you can actually see this potential on Facebook. It's not realized, it's mostly social exchange, but it wouldn't be difficult for a group of people interested in something, whatever it was, to work together and share, and you see that happening sometimes, share their learning and develop their knowledge. So how does the main system interact with it? Well, I think the main system, what happened with Napster and the music industry? Well, in England now, a music shop selling CDs has just gone bankrupt, HMV, one of the biggest. The whole, basically, it's disruptive. I think at some point, I think that what we can do is not be too difficult about being got rid of by new and emerging possibilities, as we see with these learning centers in Mexico. New possibilities of education are emerging that will be more powerful, more effective, more empowering for people, possibly, and we should kind of be open to that and explore that and be midwives to history. Sorry, that's a bad phrase, isn't it? Facilitate changes in history rather than just try and stop them by making them illegal, which so often happens, like WikiLeaks or something. I mean, the immediate reaction, if your way of doing things is undermined, you say, well, that should be illegal. Maybe we should, you know, just try and be open and explore possibilities that are emerging.
Thank you. We'll thank Professor Vegerich still once more. Kiitos tästä ensimmäisestä osasta. Nyt on kahvia ja pullaa ilmoittautuneille ja ehkä muutamalle yli. Voit tulla kyselemään, että vieläkö riittää. Pulla on laktoositonta, eli turvallisesti